This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Last week, the British government said that it had blocked an attempt to blow up airliners headed to the United States. Authorities in London said that terrorists planned to smuggle liquid explosives aboard the planes and then detonate them in flight over the Atlantic Ocean. Security experts say that they have been concerned about and warning about this kind of attack for some time, but that governments have been slow to respond. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about airline security and perhaps also try to talk a little bit about what's going on these days with the business of air travel, talk a little bit about the economics of the business. And our guest for the program is Clinton Oster. He is professor and also associate dean at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Bloomington, and his research centers on aviation safety, airline economics, and competition policy, among other things. He's co-authored four books on aviation safety and various aspects of the U.S. airline industry's adaptation to deregulation. He's also written many papers that have been published in professional journals that have to do with transportation. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome, as always. If people would like to call in, all you need to do is dial the number. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. If you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Oster, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. Specifically, there are some things I want to talk about coming out of this most recent story that, mm-hmm. that we've had here, and I'm sure people have heard a lot about it. And if they're planning on flying anytime soon, I'm sure that they're thinking a lot about this. But I'm sure that people who follow this issue would say, well, this points to something that we have long known, that there are significant gaps in our security. Now, not only do the experts know it, but the flying public knows it if they didn't before. A very, very basic question to start out with, and we can talk about some details. So if we ask the question, if we look at airline security before 9/11 and after, and look at everything we've done since and the amount of money that we have spent, are we more secure than we were before?
Well, we're certainly more secure than we were before, in the sense that we are better at finding some kinds of threats than we were prior to 9/11. We're better at finding some kinds of threats, both in terms of those security steps that you see at the airport itself, and we're obviously better at finding some kinds of threats through intelligence and police work and that sort of thing, which is, of course, what led to discovering the threat in the UK. Mm-hmm. We're certainly better. The question of, are we doing the right things? Are we safe? Those are much more subjective kinds of questions. But I don't think there's any doubt that security has improved since 9/11.
Well, certainly there has been increased emphasis on the checked baggage, which is now examined for the possibility that there would be explosives in there. But I'm gathering that even so, that people who work in this area would have said, even though we increased the level of screening of people and of the stuff that they took with them on the plane, that there is still a weak spot, and this particular story now suggests that it could be a pretty significant weak spot.
Well, I think there are always going to be weak spots. I mean, there is. I can't envision a functioning air transportation system in which you were able to remove all of the risk. It's simply not possible to do. But we've clearly removed some of the risk. I mean, one thing that I think some people are perhaps not aware of is that 9/11, the weapons that those hijackers brought aboard the aircraft were perfectly legal things for them to have on the plane.
At that time.
At that time. Mm-hmm. In fact, anything up to a knife with about a 4-inch blade, which turns out to be a pretty big knife, was perfectly legal. The only thing we were trying to stop with passenger screening prior to 9/11 were firearms, because all the previous hijackings had basically been with firearms. So by extending that to knives as other weapons, I mean, that's clearly one sort of change. Similarly, before 9/11, we had much more sporadic attempts at detecting explosives in checked baggage. And we do that. That's much more wide. Our screening of checked baggage is much more widespread, much more complete now than it had been prior to 9/11. So there have been some important improvements.
Well, now I think that people are expecting that for the foreseeable future, if not forever, there will be new restrictions on what they're able to take with them on to the plane. And people have heard about this, so it sounds as if no liquids, no gels, no creams. So they won't be able to take bottled water or coffee or soft drinks or their gel deodorants or their hand cream or their toothpaste or a lot of other stuff that people before took, which I'm sure will greatly distress those people who try to take everything they need and their carry-ons, so they won't have to check anything.
Well, including me, in the sense that, you know, many of the trips I take are I'm sort of gone, you know, one night, and it's easy to take a carry-on bag with the things you need for one night, one that fits easily under the seat in front of you, I might add. I'm not one of these folks that tries to occupy 47 overhead luggage bins.
Oh, glad to hear
that. On the airplane. And that was a convenient way of traveling. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, with the current restrictions that are in place, you're really not going to be able to do that. You're going to have to check something. Mm-hmm. And that clearly makes the trip less convenient than it otherwise would have been.
Well, just let me ask a question about that, a sort of a practical question, because that sounds to me that if more people are going to be checking more bags, that means it might well take more time to get everybody checked in. And that also, I mean, what does that mean for the capacity of that part of the aircraft where they put that stuff if now suddenly things that were riding with people in the passenger cabin are now going to have to go into the cargo hold?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that's a good question. I don't think in most cases there's going to be much of an issue of filling up the cargo hold.
Okay.
It may reduce the ability of airlines to haul freight down there, although they don't do much of that in domestic travel anyway. So I don't think there's much of an issue there. But if you're going to end up checking far more bags and having fewer carry-ons, that means the airlines are either going to face a situation where it takes even longer to get your check back than mm-hmm. it does now, which seems almost inconceivable, or a situation where they're going to have to bring on some extra people and try to speed that up. So it's clearly going to add to the cost of the airlines, and it's probably going to hit those airlines that are, you know, some of the traditional low-fare carriers like Southwest, which tend to rely more heavily on having people carry on their bags than on checking them. It's probably going to hit them, you know, proportionally a little bit harder than some of the others. So it'll probably slow things up a little bit, and it'll probably add some cost to the airlines, and it'll probably affect a little bit people's decisions on relatively short trips on whether to fly as opposed to whether to drive.
Yeah. This may be a question that is difficult or impossible to answer, but if you think about that, the fact that now people are going to have to check bags where they were carrying them on before, how much this increases the amount of checked bags? I mean, we're talking about a 20% increase, 30% increase, a 40% increase?
I don't honestly know. I mean, I think it's probably more in the 20 to 30% range, but that's just a wild guess on my part. I really don't know the answer to that. But I don't, as I say, I don't think there's an issue of capacity on the aircraft, but it will clearly take additional labor, additional workers to handle that baggage, mm-hmm. get it on and off, and you'll need some additional people at the various hub airports to transfer the bags from one plane to another, and it could even slow that up a little bit.
To address the issue of people, the possibility of people taking something on the plane that they can do damage with, looking at this kind of scenario that we talked about, where apparently the idea was that people had some kind of explosive liquid that they were taking on the aircraft disguised as something particularly, you know, perfectly innocuous that would be, you wouldn't suspect, and that somehow you could put that together and make a bomb and detonate it, short of telling people that they can't take anything on the plane with them except the clothes that they're wearing and, you know, maybe some other stuff, or perhaps subjecting people to a little bit higher level searches, then what do you do? And is it possible to implement a kind of screening technology that would deal with this kind of threat?
Well, part of the difficulty is that there's such a highly varied number of threats that in terms of a screening technology. And much of the focus so far has been on, of course, the more traditional explosives, those that have, been more commonly used in the past to blow up airplanes, plastic explosives and the like, because those were perceived as the greatest threats. And that's what we really focus on in checked baggage. I think there are so many different ways of creating a potential problem in the passenger compartment of an aircraft that the notion that we could have a sort of foolproof screening technology that would let you take everything innocuous on and would get all those things that either singly or in combination weren't innocuous, that's just not going to happen anytime soon, if ever. And so maybe that means we're either going to have to accept a little bit of risk or we're going to have to restrict things. But, I'd point out that these explosives, these combination of explosives, have been known and understood for a long time. Nobody's ever used one yet. Nobody's ever gotten one on an airplane yet. So there's that. The other thing is, in the same way that after 9/11, one of the things that I suspect is most people would agree with is that if you saw somebody from the back of the airplane start running toward the front of an airplane, the odds are that the fellow passengers would jump and kill this person before they ever got close to the cockpit door, just out of their concerns. My guess is now that if some person, even innocuously, appeared to be mixing two things on an airplane, that the fellow passengers would jump them, no matter how innocuous it was. I mean, there is now a different reaction that passengers are going to have. We just had a situation earlier today on a plane from the UK where there was a confrontation on the plane and the plane had to divert to Boston. And it doesn't appear, it was some strange behavior. Doesn't appear to have been particularly threatening behavior, but boy, the response was immediate.
Yeah.
So we have changed, passengers' reactions a little bit.
Now, that certainly suggests that the business for the flight attendants and people who work in the airlines, the business of dealing with passengers, particularly in flight, gets bumped up a few more notches if people have that level of anxiety that they're virtually sitting the whole flight looking around the people at them just trying to make sure that they're not doing anything suspicious.
It certainly makes what's already a difficult job for the flight attendants an even more difficult one. I think that's right.
Our guest is Clinton Oster. He's professor and associate dean at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Bloomington. His research centers on a number of things, including aviation safety, airline economics, and competition policy. And we're talking about issues of safety, security, and perhaps also solvency. And we'll get to some of those issues, too, in this hour of the show. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Charleston to talk with here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about the business economic implications of all this. Up until about 2001, early 2001, I was the prototypical road warrior, probably flew 100, 200,000 miles a year, was gone all the time in the States and overseas. And thank God I retired and I don't have to put up with that kind of hassle, especially with all the security and delays and so forth. My take on this is that increasingly, aside from the fear factor of flying and concern for one's danger and so forth. I suspect that more and more people are going to conclude, as I have, that if I'm going to take a trip of from point A to point B, it's going to have to be at least 500 or 600 miles apart before I'd even consider getting on an airplane because of the just the sheer time involved in having to be at the airport early, the uncertainties of schedule delays, and so on and so forth. There's been a long-term trend of growth in the airline business. I don't know what the percentage growth has been per year. I suspect it's probably high single digits or double digits in terms of number of passengers, flights, and so forth. I would bet that the long-term outlook for the economics of the airlines and the business model is probably going to, I wouldn't say a nosedive, but it's certainly going to flatten out as more and more people conclude that notwithstanding crowded highways and infrequent public land surface options, that it's just not worth the hassle, frankly, of flying. And I'd like your take on that.
Well, I think there's some very limited evidence so far that suggests that at least in part you're right. I mean, we've seen a trend in the airline industry for quite some time that sort of the average flight taken by a passenger was getting longer, and much of that was because of the faster growth in international travel than in domestic travel in the U.S. But since 2001, because of the fact that it does now take longer, you know, it typically is going to add maybe an hour to what it used to at each airport check-in. There has been a bit of a fall off in the shorter traffic, and in those relatively short flights. And if you look at the behavior of people, you know, when I even look at my own behavior, places that, you know, in the late 90s I would fly, I now drive.
Yeah.
And I think that to the extent that these additional restrictions that have been put on will add to the inconvenience, that may well, again, you know, push that sort of dividing line between fly and drive, it may push it out another couple hundred miles.
I think it's really going to impact the lucrative business traveler who flies at short notice, pays high premium fares, and so forth. Don't you think?
Well, it'll make they're going to make that decision. The business traveler is going to make that decision purely on time and convenience. And when you add to the time of flying, you haven't done anything to change the time of driving. So you're definitely going to push that away. And so there has been already a fall off in the very short haul travel, and these latest restrictions most likely will make that happen some more.
Well, I was absolutely astounded when they were talking about not allowing people flying from Heathrow to the States, and I've made that trip many times. Not even allowed to bring a magazine or a book, let alone a laptop computer, so you could do something productive in that time frame.
I think it's likely to change.
The number of new bus services that have come up recently, like $1 or $2, really, you know, cheap way to go. But I would predict that probably you'll see more and more deluxe, luxury class ground transportation alternatives, maybe using buses, maybe even trains. I don't know.
You may see part of that, although my guess is most of it's still going to be private auto, because the business traveler needs that schedule flexibility that they want to have. Now, I would be surprised if some of the restrictions on things like books and magazines that were put on, the last week, I'd be very surprised if those stay.
Yeah.
That was, I think, just a question of they were trying. I'm not going to call it overreaction, but there was a real concern about their ability to do that kind of screening. And I suspect that at least for books and magazines and that sort of thing, I think we're going to see those things put back on. In the U.S., of course, we have not yet banned laptops.
Just a closing comment. Several days after President Reagan had the Air Force attacked Gaddafi in Libya back in the 80s, I was flying out of Heathrow coming back to the States, and they put really, really tight security constraints at the time. And I remember, apropos of liquids, them really checking closely the perfume bottles of one of the fellow passengers I was with. I mean, it was check in at the curb, check at the baggage area, check-in place, check in the final boarding, and so on. I'd never seen anything things like that, and I suppose that's probably what we're seeing today.
Yeah, and we'll see some backing off, I think, of some of those things that were done quickly. And I think a little, as we get a little bit more, dare I say, rationality added to that.
And I think, isn't it true that we would expect that sometime within the next few days that the TSA, the Transportation Safety...
Security
Administration, the people who do the security screening, there will be new rules about what you can take on the plane, and I'm sure that at least for people who have the internet access, you can go to the TSA website, which is tsa.gov, and I'm sure that you could find out what that is, and then that anybody who's going to be now traveling for the foreseeable future better know what the rules are, what you can take, and you know what to expect before you get to the airport.
That's right, and you may travelers may still want to be even a little cautious, because when things are changing quickly like that, the website will have it right away. Sometimes the message doesn't get to the screeners quite as quickly as it gets to the website. So they're trying to improve that, and I'm sure they will. But I think caution on what you choose to put in your checked baggage for the next few weeks would be the word.
Even on check bags?
On check bags, I don't think anything's particularly changed, except that there's going to be a lot more scrutiny.
Yeah. Okay.
But for carry-on bags, I think you know people ought to be really careful.
All right, let's talk with someone else here in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. My gosh, lots of things to talk about this morning. I have a question and a couple observations. For those of us who have already planned a trip outside the country for later this fall, do you see much of an easing of the restrictions? Do you think it will go by airline?
I don't think you're going to see much variation across airlines. There was a little bit of a variation in the initial reaction among some of the U.S. carriers, but I think that'll quickly stabilize. The U.K. has already eased restrictions a little bit over what they were a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm.
I would not expect them to ease much more. So I think if I were planning an international trip, I would probably think pretty carefully about trying to put all of those things that have been restricted in my checked baggage and really minimize.
Yeah, that's kind of a sore point, because I really hate checking baggage. It doesn't always get where you're going.
It can typically, especially with international travel, it can typically take a long time
right to
recover your bag. But I think that's just a very, very unfortunate consequence. And the one tip that can help, and I'm sure you know this, but for others who don't, it can really help if you put a card with your name and address and what your destination is inside your bag.
Oh, absolutely.
So that if the stuff gets ripped off on the outside when they open the bag, if they can find that right away, it increases your chance of seeing your bag again considerably.
Mm-hmm. One observation I wanted to make, actually, too. I just read yesterday about the shoe removal and X-ray requirements that are now in place. And according to what I read, it's absolutely useless, because the X-ray equipment that they use has no way of picking up liquids or gels that might be hidden in shoe soles or whatever. And the second observation I'd like to make is that I think they have overreacted. If you have already cleared security and you are in a supposedly secure area of the airport where there are food vendors and so on who presumably anyway have also been cleared, why can you not purchase water or food from them and take it aboard? It seems to me that that's where there's a lack of security.
Well, I would—I have no comment on your second observation, because I'm puzzled by that as well. But I would like to comment briefly on the shoe issue, because I think this is a case where Some of the media handling of this has been a little more sensational and a little less thoughtful than it might otherwise have been. It's clearly true that the X-ray machines that we use for screening carry-on bags and for screening passenger shoes and that sort of thing don't have some alarm light that lights up if there's an explosive there. That's really not what they're designed to detect. That's when they use the little wipe that they wipe over the outside of bags and that sort of thing. That has much better capabilities of detecting explosives. However, put yourself in the position of the TSA security guy. You know, you've seen X-rays of just about any kind of shoe coming through that you can. So you know what shoes look like. If a portion of that shoe, the heel, for example, is hollowed out or something else is put in there that's not normal, that X-ray is going to look different. Now, it isn't designed to detect that explosive, but it's going to look different to the TSA inspector. So I think that making the leap that so much of the media did from saying these particular devices were not designed with the purpose of detecting explosives to it's completely useless from a standpoint of detecting explosives to run these things through these devices, that's a little bit bigger leap than I think is warranted, and I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration.
Well, I wondered about it when I read it, and some part of it did make sense.
The other thing I guess I would observe is if you're gonna create problems with explosives on an airplane, if you're gonna whatever blow up the airplane or create an in cabin fire or whatever it might be, you need both the explosive and some sort of an ignition device.
Correct.
And so if you have the ability to detect or have a shot at detecting either one of those, that's enough to make you suspicious and to stop it. So and many of the more common ignition devices are things that can show up with these X-rays.
Well, I'll hope for a safe flight in October.
And just wear shoes that are easy to get on and off.
Oh, all the time. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Okay. Other questions are certainly welcome. Let me again just quickly introduce our guest, Clinton Oster. He's a professor and associate dean at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, Indiana University, Bloomington. His research centers on a number of different things, but it includes aviation safety, airline economics, and competition policy. He's authored or co-authored 4 books on aviation safety and also on various aspects of the U.S. airline industry's adaptation to deregulation. And he's written a number of papers that have been published in various kinds of professional journals that have to do with transportation issues. Questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me just ask you one or maybe a couple more things that have to do with the security issues.
Mm-hmm.
In the wake of this alleged plot, I think that some people, particularly some members of Congress, in the way that in their comments about what we're doing in terms of security point to something else that is a concern, or it seems like that it should be a concern, that we are still not screening all cargo that goes onto the airplanes. And while perhaps on passenger planes, there's not a lot of cargo, there is some. We're doing random checks. The companies, cargo companies, have to register with the government, but still some people are saying here is a significant, another significant gap that we have not addressed to the extent that we should.
Well, it's certainly the case that if you look at international passenger flights in particular, most of those flights carry a significant amount of cargo in the belly of the aircraft. Not so much on domestic flights. That's fairly unusual for but on international flights, it's not unusual. And it's also the case that the screening devices that we use on suitcases were designed to do suitcases. And cargo presents a different kind of challenge. There are some steps, of course, that I think you're referring to the known shipper program.
Mm-hmm.
There are some steps, of course, that the government has taken. These problems have been known and understood since before 2001, including to those members of Congress who are now suddenly purporting to be surprised. But That's really, I'm afraid, all that I'm prepared to say on that. I unfortunately have been involved in some explosive detection studies for cargo, and so I'm a little bit compromised in the sense that, I'd really not talk about, prefer not to talk about any of the sort of detection or technical issues, other than to say people are working on this problem. Some progress has been made. We don't have a foolproof system, but then we don't have a foolproof system for any aspects of aviation security, and I don't think that we ever will. We have not, however, had any airplanes blown up because of bombs placed in cargo since 2001, or since even shortly before that.
All right. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana. Line one.
Well, I
yes.
have a question. For a number of years, photo stores have been selling lead bags for carrying film on board airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Are those still permissible? And if they are, if you can put a piece, a roll of film in one, why couldn't someone put explosives in one?
Well, I think you probably could put explosives in one, but it's when I have traveled with film, what I've simply done is rather than use those bags, have simply asked the inspectors if they would hand inspect the film rather than put it through the X-ray machine, and every time I've done that, they've been quite accommodating. So I'm not sure that those bags are necessary, and of course this is becoming much less of an issue in an era of a growing era of digital cameras, because there's no issue with damaging anything on the digital cameras when you go through the X-ray. But it's my impression now that when those bags are detected in carry-on luggage, that is typically then hand inspected by the TSA people, rather than simply allowed to go through that way.
I've only had one problem with hand inspection. I had an inspector here at Willard absolutely refused to let it go through. He wanted to X-ray it no matter what.
Well, there are differences among mm-hmm. people. As I say, I've been quite fortunate. The other thing is that it's usually an issue that unless it gets X-rayed a bunch of times, a single X-ray is not likely to damage the film in any significant way. It's only if it happens repeatedly, because the doses are pretty small.
Yeah, but if you are in the habit of pushing films with enlargements of 16 by 20 or so, then I think it does degrade.
Then it can be an issue, and then I think you just hope for a hand inspection.
Well, what I've done now recently is simply buy the film when I arrive, develop it before I leave, or mail it home.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah.
I was wondering about those bags, because that seemed to, if it can conceal the roll of film, it...
And I think the era when they were willing to let those go through were more of an era when their primary concern were firearms.
Mm-hmm.
And those bags are typically small enough that you're not going to easily put a firearm in it.
It'd be pretty difficult.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right,
certainly.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We certainly, the airlines have had some difficult times, economically speaking, over the last few years. The aftershocks of 9/11, overall increased pressures, competitive pressures. Passengers chasing the lowest fares and airlines having to try to deal with that. More recently, the cost of fuel, a very serious issue, and of course, cost of security. And I guess I just wonder, if you look at all of those things, that what the burden of increased security on the airlines has been, and of what, you know, when you take a look at the amount of money that we have spent on increased security since 9/11, and look at how much of that the government has paid and how much of that the airlines have paid, and I suppose ultimately we're paying, no matter whether the government's paying or the airlines are paying, but of that share and how it breaks down that way, how much has been government money and how much has come out of the pockets of the airlines?
Well, I think for the most part the costs, the sort of out-of-pocket costs, if you will, of added security, has been borne primarily by the government. The cost to the airlines, I think, is more by slowing the process up, the process of check-in and that sort of thing, they're losing a little bit of travel, you know, partly on the short-haul flights, but partly on the longer flights. And one of the things that you want to try to keep in mind about the sort of underlying economics of the airline industry is, if you think about a flight that's just about ready to go, if it's going to cost about the same to operate that flight no matter how many passengers are on it. So that if I can put a passenger, if I'm an airline and I can put a passenger in a seat that was about to be empty, that's just almost entirely new revenue to me with almost no additional cost. So when traffic's growing, that's great because it means if I can add a couple of passengers, my profits go up a lot. The downside is, of course, that if I lose a passenger, maybe because of the inconvenience, and if that seat is now empty, my costs haven't gone down, but my revenues have gone down. So airline profits are really very volatile in terms of just small changes in traffic. I mean, traffic didn't fall that dramatically after September 11th, but profits just plummeted. Now, if we look at the impact of security, to the extent that this is discouraging some people from traveling, it could have a substantial impact on airline finances that way.
Mm-hmm.
The other, I guess, point I'd make on airline finances, the other thing I think that's going on, fuel prices are high, although we've seen, if you adjust for inflation, we've seen nearly these high fuel prices in the past. Maybe not quite, but fairly close. But I think that in the boom of the late 1990s, the so-called dot-com boom, when there was a tremendous amount of traffic, I think that some of the airlines got a little sloppy. The stock market was booming, and they used that as an excuse to underfund their pensions. They were providing some very generous wage and work rule settlements to their employees. And as we moved into this later era, as we saw growth of lower-cost carriers like Southwest Airlines or more recently JetBlue or some of the others, the airlines found that they had really created a situation for themselves with pensions and with labor and with some of their other management practices that just wasn't competitive anymore. And those adjustments, you know, we've seen pensions drop through bankruptcy, we've seen pressure on pensions, we've seen changes in work rules, we've seen pressure on labor groups to accept lower wages and that sort of thing. It's a very, very difficult time for the industry. And then you add the fuel prices and these added security inconveniences, if you will. It's going to be pretty challenging for them for the next few years as well.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough business. I came across the quote I really liked. I'm not exactly sure what to make of it, but apparently Warren Buffett, the great investment guru, apparently once said, in spite of all the money that's gone into the airlines, the net profit is less than zero. I don't know how that can be. What does that actually make sense?
Well, what happens is you get some people that sort of add up over time profits and losses in the industry over the, you know, sort of since the days of Orville and Wilbur. And when they add them all up and don't maybe adjust very much for inflation or whatever, you can end up with sort of a negative number.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's sort of one of these nice little gee whiz things, but I don't think it's particularly pertinent because if you'd added those numbers up in late 1999, you would have seen enormous profits. In late 1999 and early 2000, the airlines were making bigger profits than they'd ever made before.
Hmm.
It's just that this is a pretty volatile industry. And it's also the case that in the past, when things got better, a lot of airline managers tended to go out and buy lots of new airplanes. And the one thing that's been interesting over the past, say, 2 or 3 years, as the economy's actually been improving a little bit, is for the first time that I'm aware of, airline managers have finally resisted some of that trend. And so what we now see are, you know, a higher percentage of seats filled, higher load factors in industry terms, than we've ever seen before. So maybe some of these managers are getting a little bit more clever, finally, about how to run an industry that's prone to such cycles.
Well, it is the case, or at least you correct me if I'm wrong. Here's a statistic that today, airlines representing approximately half of the total seat capacity in the United States are in Chapter 11. Is that?
That's probably close to right, or if it isn't, it depends on who just came out and who's just going in.
Yeah.
But I think that you want to be a little careful when you think about bankruptcy in the airline industry, because one of the issues that comes up is that if you're sitting there with labor contracts that you believe are too expensive to allow you to prosper in the future, or with underfunded pensions that are where that pension liability is just so enormous that you're going to have a lot of trouble getting out from underneath it, it's pretty tempting to go into bankruptcy and attempt to push that pension off on the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation and to use bankruptcy to throw out some of your labor contracts. So there are some reasons why some airlines might want to move into bankruptcy a little bit sooner that don't necessarily apply to bankruptcies in other industries. So I think it's a little tricky. Some of these bankruptcies have a little bit of a strategic element to them.
Hmm. But
not that in any way reduces the pain on the employees, but still.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left. Again, let me one more time introduce our guest, Clint Oster. He's professor and associate dean at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University at Bloomington. His research, among other things, deals with aviation safety, airline economics, and competition policy. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I'm still sort of curious here. If you go back, you talked about the fact that if you go back to 1999, that the airlines were doing really well. They were making money. And now, 6-7 years later, they're certainly facing a lot of, again, all the shakeout from September 11th, increased security, increased fuel costs, increased competition. So they're facing a lot of pressures. And you talked about the fact that maybe sometimes when they're doing well, that people who run the airlines can't resist the opportunity to do something in the way of expansion. If you ask this question, well, really, was there, of all of these things, was there any one thing that sort of stands out more than the others in that happened over those period of years that has made it so difficult? Is there any one thing, or is it just a combination of all of those things?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a combination of all of them, but there is one thing in my mind that stands out. And that's almost one of these be careful what you wish for kinds of stories, because what was going on during this period in the late 90s was at that point it was still the case that an awful lot of airline tickets were sold through travel agents, and that while the airlines had been putting some pressure on travel agents to lower their commissions, they still were looking and saying, boy, we sure would like to figure out a way to lower those distribution costs, that cost of getting tickets in the hands of passengers. And so they started going much more heavily to internet sales. And, you know, because it's cheaper to sell a ticket, all else equal, on via the internet than it is through a sort of traditional bricks and mortar kind of travel agent. The problem with that, and the thing that they didn't think of, was that if I'm going through a travel agent, and I'll sort of go call up the travel agent and say, I want to go from city A to city B, and here's about when I'd like to go, and so forth. And the travel agent will come back and say, well, how about take airline X and this flight? And you'll say, yeah, that's fine. If I go to the internet, I have the option of very quickly surveying everybody's offerings. I know what happens if I move my departure time a couple hours, or if I go to an alternate airport. I can see what the low-cost carriers are doing. I have sort of complete information, or it's easy to get pretty complete information. With the bricks-and-mortar travel agents in the old days, that really was much harder to do. In addition, what the airlines were able to do with the travel agents was pay something called travel agent commission overrides, which was essentially a bribe paid under the table by the airlines to the travel agents to steer passengers onto their airline instead of onto a competing airline. Can't do that very well on the Internet. So one of the things that happened was when they went to Internet distribution, passengers suddenly became much more aware of their flight options. The ability to charge business travelers extraordinarily high fares started to evaporate pretty quickly. And I think that's one of the things that contributed to the downfall, the financial downfall of many of these more traditional airlines. And it was, in some sense, a self-inflicted wound.
Let's take another call here. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Yes, I read an article, I believe, recently on the New York Times, maybe even front page, concerning the approaching lapse of terrorism insurance. And how the airline industry was lobbying feverishly for Congress to extend this. I believe it may expire in September because of the tremendous government subsidies and indemnities involved in that. Are you aware of issues surrounding the upcoming lapse of terrorism insurance if Congress does not reauthorize it?
I'm aware there was that issue, but I honestly don't know what the current status of it is.
Okay.
I think most people's expectation is that it will get reauthorized. What happened was a lot of the private insurance coverage, you know, private insurers are really happy to insure you as long as nothing goes wrong, but they tend to get really scared when something goes wrong, and they didn't know how to handle a sort of post 9/11 world, and so I think that's why there was a little bit of government.
Well, they didn't know how to price a risk that was really, you know, they didn't know how the nature of the risk, so it's hard for them to price it.
That's right, and I'm not sure. I guess it's a matter of whether you want to call that a subsidy or not. I suppose you could. I don't think it was a particularly significant subsidy to the industry, at least compared to some of the other ones that happened after 9/11. But I honestly don't know the state of that in Congress right now.
I don't believe government has had to pay that, but still you want that protection if you're in the airline business. My next question goes to how safe are we in the airline industry post 9/11? And I thought I heard on maybe CNN, I don't want to attribute it to CNN, but one of the talk shows, 24/7 news programs, that we're worried about, you know, what's in the carry-on luggage, but I thought I heard that only a small percentage of the check-in baggage, that which goes into the cargo bay, is actually checked to see if there is any anything wrong or any increased risk involved in that. Is that correct?
Now, it's a... You know, I can't say that there aren't bags that occasionally may get on a plane without having gone through the X-ray machines in the airports. But we do have all those machines now, and we're doing really a couple of kinds of things. One is the vast majority of them do get sent through that machine. The other thing we're doing is passenger bag matching, on most normal flights, I mean, there can occasionally be missed connections and that sort of thing, but on most normal flights, they're not going to let the bag be on the airplane unless they've confirmed that the passenger is on the airplane. Now, obviously, if someone is willing to commit suicide, that doesn't help, but it at least stops the people that aren't willing to commit suicide from planting a bomb in a suitcase and then not getting on the airplane.
My final question, if I might, is that whenever this happens, and of course, thankfully, to the British Secret Service protected us, allegedly, from another 9/11 equivalent this time. But I read also, I believe in the New York Times, that the Bush administration had quietly diverted funds that would have been used for increased detection technology, which may have detected liquids of this nature. They had quietly diverted those funds to something else, and yet, of course, as soon as this is full, here they're out there saying, well, we are safe, and we're doing everything we can to make us safer.
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that there are a very large number of potential threats, and there is a clamor for research money to research techniques for all of those, and as in any other situation, there just isn't enough money to go around to do everything. I'm not aware of any sort of diversion, but I'm sure you could find somebody whose pet research project wasn't funded, who would want to make that kind of a statement.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Just in closing here, unfortunately, we're up against the end of the time. It seems that from what I read in terms of economics and American airlines in the United States, that one thing you can say without fear of contradiction is that in the future there will be fewer of them.
That may be, there may be some future periods where there are fewer of them, but we also do have a tradition of startup airlines, and there are proposals out there to start up still more airlines. So we may see some mergers and some consolidation, but we may also see some more JetBlues or folks like that.
I guess I'm thinking of is merger consolidation involving some of what the remaining legacy carriers.
It would not be surprising to see that, but I, you know, for the people that think that's going to solve the industry's capacity problem, I would point out that the real issue is the number of airplanes, not the number of CEOs.
Yeah.
So a merger doesn't necessarily pull capacity out of the system.
Well, we will have to leave it at that. Our guest, Clinton Oster, he's a professor, associate dean at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, Indiana University, Bloomington. Professor Oster, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.